Year is 1816 and things are really frickin' bad. The Industrial Revolution has happened, we've only just barely discovered Australia, and by we, I mean British people. Meanwhile, the poor are going down into mines with new mining technologies that are making it theoretically safer, although whether those technologies are actually reaching people, it's kinda questionable. It is a gloomy, gloomy time. A guy named Caleb Perry has, in a little bit of historical foreshadowing, just written the first adequate description of the Pulse. In just 3 years, the first steamship is going to cross the Atlantic. Trade is going to get an even bigger boost. Meanwhile, the rich are going out inventing travel, inventing leisure, starting to do the semester abroad, going to see battlefield sites, and then later on, different cultural and curiosity sites around Europe. Also, the world is ending. There's a mountain called Mount Tambor, and just a year before, it had exploded. This was the most powerful volcanic eruption in human history. We saw it launch 160 to 220 odd cubic kilometers of material into the air. The skies went gray and yellowed. The temperature dropped by almost a full degree Fahrenheit. Things were getting weird. Crops were dying. Caspar David Friedrich's paintings show this change. In 1810, he created one. In 1817, he created one. Those were Landscape with Rainbow and Two Men by the Sea. In one painting, you've got a beautiful, lovely sky. In one, you've got a apocalyptic yellow sky. Few words for sky. But the point is that not only was this a reflection of a literal change in the world, in the summer of 1816, that's what the sky looked like. It also reflected someone living through a period of immense change, a lot of suffering, and a real quagmire as to how this whole Industrial Revolution thing is going. Disease ravaged places all over the world. There are crop shortages. Very few people had enough. Meanwhile, people are striking, people are rioting, people are wanting fair food, wanting to have the resources to live their lives. One slogan is bread or blood. And at this point, the stage is very well set. Because while all of this is going on, while we're in the middle of the year remembered as the year without a summer, a few young radicals are meeting up in a little chateau near Lake Geneva, and they are doing some opium, telling some stories, and they're gonna give birth to modern horror. Welcome to Hidden Horrors with Devin Harding, where I'm going to tell you all about vampires and Dracules. Ha, you thought it was Frankenstein? No, you fool. It's also the birth of vampires. That meeting in Lake Geneva included Mary Shelley, Percy Blythe Shelley, Lord Byron, and a little man called John William Polidori. These are titans of literature, at least in the Western canon. All of this is from like a very Western cultural example. But they wrote things that you are going to be very familiar with. Percy Blythe Shelley wrote Ozymandias, a poem that a lot of people are going to recognize from Watchmen. I met a traveler in an antique land, yada yada yada, and the inscription read, I am Ozymandias, king of kings, look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. Byron is best known for Don Juan and for kind of inventing the concept of personal branding. He was well known as a bit of a rascal. He was also an example of a concept he came up with, the Byronic hero, someone who's outside of culture yet still fairly wealthy and high up in it, and who is funny, quick-witted, who doesn't want to be told what to do and kind of rebels against authority. You might recognize this concept from everything ever made in the last 50 years. Also, Lord Byron's daughter was Ada Lovelace, or Ada. I apologize, I'm mispronouncing all of these names. But she was the woman who invented computer programming, and she was Lord Byron's daughter. I did not know. Now, normally this story is framed around Mary Shelley. She is having all these conversations with these people, doing a lot of opium, and she has a dream in the middle of the night in which the concept of Frankenstein kind of reveals itself in front of her. All of this I will talk about sometime, but it's also reflecting this year in the gloomy atmosphere, the rise of science, it's reflecting Victorians having to deal with people doing autopsies for the first time, and grave robbery. However, less well known is the contributions of John William Polidori. This whole excursion resulted in him writing a short called The Vampire. Even when it came out, people contributed it to Lord Byron. In fact, Lord Byron basically wrote some notes and created a short draft that eventually Polidori did the work on to develop into the story. This is the birth of the classical fictional vampire. This is the first time that anyone puts that idea together. The fact that it came from the same drug-fueled party as Frankenstein blows my mind. The vampire laid down a lot of what vampire fiction was going to be after this. There's a wealthy foreign someone from some dark part of Europe that the British were snooty about. He comes over to Britain, there's some seduction of women, a lot of women go insane, blood is drank, he dies, he comes back, there's a wedding, it's a whole thing. Side note, if any swarthy foreigners want to drink your blood, watch out. So this story, it kind of merged a lot of different folklore together. I'm going to tell you a little bit about pre-existing vampire folklore, but none of it was quite in the same place. None of it was quite the same from moment to moment. In fact, when we look at it, like, the concept of a vampire gets pretty iffy in history before this. There's the real vampire, the folk vampire, and that is a profoundly different thing from the, like, blue, suck your blood type vampire that we get from fiction after this. What it did, though, was it tapped into a new audience. Through a whole variety of reasons, people are able to read more material now. You're able to print things that aren't religious tracts, that aren't, like, great epic Western literature. You're able to produce new and pulpy stories that are more designed to be thrown away and are more accessible to a wider audience. An audience that, as soon as it can read whatever it wants, invents the vampire. Now, I talk a lot about history on here, but if I'm going on YouTube and I'm going on my podcast and I'm talking about history, it is as a YouTuber or a podcaster. There's not the same level of research. But if you can give me a moment, a historical idea that is really interesting here is thinking about eras, thinking about dividing up human history. The fact is, anything organic, and human history is very organic, adamantly rejects and tries to rebel against categorization. Ask a biologist how well genuses and families actually tend to match reality sometimes. There's always conflict. In the same way, pinning down the modern era or the medieval era or whatever, it's very tricky. It's going to mean different things to different people, and it really only makes any sense within the culture that is kind of taking ownership of what they're talking about. But that being said, if I had to talk about eras of human history, at least through culture, at least through genre, I would call the birth of horror, the birth of vampire fiction, and of Frankenstein, we'll get to them, I would call that the start of the modern day, of modern horror, of modern cultural tastes in a very specific Western context. Suddenly we have this huge climate disaster, something that has people feeling real bad about the rest of the world. I don't want to be the type of YouTuber that's like, and this explains modern reality, but we can relate. Things felt a little shaky. At the same time that the Industrial Revolution is making printing presses more available, is making them able to produce a higher volume, is able to make the cost of running it and the manpower of running it significantly lower, we're also seeing people face radically different economic circumstances. People are coming to work in cities, the rise of the factory. Things are changing very rapidly, and a lot of people are finding that they don't have the same lifestyle and the same patterns as their parents. In this moment of intense discontent, suddenly they're able to access stories that express that discontent, that reflect a kind of horrific world. It provides a bit of relief, especially when the villain happens to look a lot like some of the people that were benefiting at this time, albeit with a weird, the foreigner coming over type lens. So, with the rise of working shifts, with the rise of unions being able to provide some stability to working hours, we have people who are also having free time, and that's another important element. If you got free time, if people are able to make cheap media, suddenly there's a new market. Regardless, this is a very, very popular story, and more stories follow. Varney the Vampire. God, I love the name, Varney the Vampire. I want a modern reboot. But Varney the Vampire comes out in the 1840s, and that's the era of penny dreadfuls. I was saying that horror got more accessible, it went down through the middle class, maybe through some of the, like, working middle class that was emerging at the time, which an economics professor will correct me. But by the 1840s, we've got penny dreadfuls. That's when it becomes cheap enough to print that you can make material that could be sold for a penny to someone who is working a shift at a factory, who's got off, who's got a bit of free time after work. And printing presses in this period, suddenly you're going from having like a team of people operating them to having one or two people operating them, and you're able to put out way more material in a single day. That's why the cost has gone down so much. And when you can have people reading whatever they want, well, that's when it gets real violent, real crass. It also kind of corresponds to the rise of true crime, but we'll get into that another day. But people are reading Varney the Vampire. They're wanting some blood and guts. This is the birth of pulp media. Media that's printed to be thrown away. Media that is printed to make an impact for a moment, but not to stand the test of time. These are not great novels. It's also the birth of a publishing culture that pays people in accordance to what they think that's worth. This is the birth of the type of fiction that gets me out of bed in the morning. Sheridan Le Fanu is a legendary mystery, horror, and ghost story writer who wrote Carmilla in 1872. He rebelled against the culture and the idea of womanhood that was dominant in the 1870s by making his vampire a powerful lesbian woman who seduces our heroine and in doing so kind of liberates her. As soon as people can write stories that are accessible by everyone, as soon as people establish horror media, suddenly we've got people who want to rebel by having topics that were absolutely not open dinner table conversation in the Victorian period. I'll be honest that I haven't had the time to read Carmilla, but from the descriptions that I've read, it seems as though the relationship is supposed to be horrifying and that it is a lot more equal and a lot more mutually beneficial than a lot of Victorian relationships at the time. On the other hand, the Victorian period, remember it as being so uptight. We remember it as women in insanely tight corsets, forgetting that those were for the absolute wealthiest women. For every woman that was in an insane corset, there were probably 7 women who wouldn't wear a corset for their life and were out there on the streets, popping a squat and taking a pee. The point is, Victorian nobility was prescribed by the very rich, was rebelled against by the very poor, and by the time Carmilla is coming out, that rebellion is actually seeping not just from the poor, but also to a new middle class. Dracula would come out not that long after that, in 1897. It would be pretty much as sexual, a lot more subtle, maybe a bit less transgressive, but it was still a huge culture shock. I'll leave that to the literary people to discuss. By the time that Dracula came out, the fictional vampire was well established. Really, it would be defined a bit more into specific images, the blah, I suck your blood type version by movies coming out. But even then, the set of powers and abilities, the stakes, the rules of what a vampire is, are formed. Before this, folk vampires had individual beliefs about them relating to the local culture, but there was no hard defined set of rules of, well, when people go in sunlight, they burn, when you stab them, they die. Vampires too. I mean vampires. The point is, these early stories create a fictional vampire, a vampire that is a separate entity from the kind of folk vampire before. It is telling that vampires, fiction with some sex in it, fiction with some violence in it, they all come out at the very same time. Maybe people should think of the Victorians less as people trying to rigidly control sexuality, and more as mostly being people who didn't have the money to meet those standards and often rebelled against them. We remember the Victorians for the rigid morality, and we forget that the subversion of that morality leapt out of it because people were struggling, people demanded it, people didn't want to just read about how great the wealthy were and how moral they were. However, like I said, history actively resists categorization. I've told you that the vampire started in 1816, and that's certainly a good argument, but there are plenty of other vampires, there's plenty of other ways to tell this story. Many people might choose a different starting point. For example, Western poems in the world of poetry have featured vampires since at least 1700, and cultural depictions outside of fiction, modern fiction, outside of the thing that was emerging at the time, yeah, they go back farther. And then there's the so-called historical vampires, Vlad the Impaler and Elizabeth Bathory and the like, who have had their stories kind of converted into it from a modern lens, but also were kind of described as vampires at the time. I'll get into it if we get to an episode about them. Then there's the fact that we've taken a wide variety of European folk vampires and called them all the same thing. I mean, even more than that, sometimes we call lots of folk creatures from around the world vampires. We take monsters that are pretty wildly different, other than the fact that they are the dead that consume the alive to stay alive. We call those vampires. But if that's our definition, that's basically all of our monsters. Then vampires and zombies and werewolves and all these kinds of things are all basically vampires. And maybe in a sense they are. But I think the more interesting way to look at it is that all of these roots come to the modern words that we're using. Just as we can kind of retroactively use vampire to describe a lot of things that maybe aren't actually vampires, maybe we're just using the Western word for ghoul and not being critical about it. maybe at the same time, all of those different things came together to form the fictional vampire. The real thing to gather here is to take each individual thing as its own thing, and they are really interesting. There's also an argument that the modern, like, European vampire is very influenced by, like, some very old anti-Semitic myths that were popular in Christian populations at the time. I'm just gonna mention it. You don't need a YouTuber to tell you about that. Read books. But Ifeazi, a vampire-like creature from South Africa that turns into a mosquito and lures children to their doom, is a vampire. What makes a zombie not a vampire? I think probably the more interesting thing to say is, well, in some specific European cultures, the idea of a vampire emerged because there is some kind of human fear of the dead feeding on us to sustain themselves. But instead, also, there's another thing over here that may be reflecting the same fear, but can't be understood by just categorizing it into vampires. There's the Asimbosum, a supposed African vampire that has iron teeth and leaps on you from trees, which is very cool, but definitely not the same thing as, like, a modern Dracula vampire. These things shouldn't be studied in the shadow of what vampires are. They should be studied as a really cool thing that you talk to an expert about, and not me. In Europe, the tradition of the kind of demonic pseudo-vampire ghoul thing goes back quite a ways. You can find stories in that cultural legacy in ancient Greece and ancient Rome. You can find them all the way back to mid-Eastern civilizations like Mesopotamia and Babylon. But classics is not my forte. Latin is too hard. Now, you can find revenants and draugr, you can find all these things in Europe from the 1200s. Eventually, in the medieval period, you start to get more vampires, like, vampires. One vampire panic in Croatia saw local peasants thinking that a lord had risen from the dead as a vampire. He was described as going around town, causing trouble, and, quote, sexually harassing his wife, which the villagers weren't fond of. Go villagers! They murdered him. Villagers drove a stake through his heart and decapitated the body. Good for them. In the 18th century, there was a series of these types of panics called the vampire controversies. Like many places where myth and reality kind of intersect, we're seeing a bit of a moral panic here. And before we start judging people from the Middle Ages as being dumb, we should remember that Western countries to this day often have moral panics, often along very similar lines, often about cultural elite drinking blood. We have not gotten over this. We are mere memes away from people thinking that vampires exist today. Vampires were the subject of anti-witchcraft books such as Demonology, published by King James, and these texts kept coming out right through the 1700s. My promise to you, we're gonna talk about witches, we're gonna talk about real witchcraft, we're gonna talk about studies that show that at least some healthcare-related witch spells really worked. One of the anti-witchcraft books was called the Malleus Maleficarum, or the Witch's Hammer. So do people really believe in vampires? That is a really interesting question. It really depends on when and where, it depends on what you're saying a vampire is. The lines of myth and reality are often going to intersect. In places where there were cultural myths of vampires, is this something that everyone believed? Is it something that some people understood as a way to talk to children about certain concepts? Is it something that was not that real, but in a panic could become really real for real? There's lots of different options, and depending on the place and the culture, you're going to get lots of different answers. So, kind of. The reality is, history's gone, we're kind of piecing it back together as best as we can, but there's probably a lot of different explanations for vampires happening at the same time, and they're probably all true in some circumstances and some situations. For example, a big one is that if you open up a corpse box, otherwise known as a coffin, you would see a corpse that maybe had bloated up with gas, looking like it had eaten. You would see where its nail beds might have shrank back, revealing more nails, and where its hair would have come out, making it look like it's still alive. And that's probably true in a lot of situations. It's not the total cause of the vampire myth, but it is something where, in a panic, it would be just stoking the fire. At the same time, vampires also might be a good tool for teaching ideas about the body and decomposition. Vampires might be a way to explain life and death in a culture where people would encounter it a lot. Maybe sometimes you need to have ghouls for children so that they can understand it. That definitely continues today. In 1985, David Delphine published a paper That said, the vampirism historically might have been a reaction to polyphuria. This is a blood disease that can be treated by transplanting blood. Among other ideas was the idea that someone might drink blood and then have it absorbed through the stomach lining, helping to treat the disease. The problem is, and the way that people have talked about it since, is that the mythological, the historical, the folk vampire didn't necessarily drink blood. It didn't necessarily have these modern traits. He was describing the fictional vampire, not the cultural one. Media attention spread the idea. It became a widespread cultural misconception through no fault of his own. Guy just wrote a paper. But it's an interesting idea. There are other diseases that might contribute to it. There are diseases that might make people look more like vampires. By no means discount the idea that disease had an impact on historical conceptions of horror. Like, imagine a world pre-TikTok and you see someone with rabies and you're like, well, I've heard of demons, so that'll do it. Imagine being a peasant in a village where you didn't have modern education or modern technology, you didn't have germ theory, you didn't understand a lot about disease. You would know what rabies was, but the line between that and what you might be told about a demon or a ghoul, that might start to become blurred, and there might also be negative perceptions because of that. However, one explanation that I think is key is understanding that there is an economic thing going on here. Vampires emerged in a period of extreme wealth disparity, and in a period of extreme famine, and in a period where people did not have many resources, mostly because of the whole year without a summer thing. Vampires are wealthy people living off in castles, taking the lifeblood of villagers while villagers suffer. The economic metaphor is not very subtle. I'm not gonna advocate for any economic position, but I think it's telling that when Karl Marx is trying to describe capitalism, he says that capitalism is like a vampire. Dead labor, which vampire-like, lives only by sucking living labor, and lives the more labor it sucks. Vampire is a modern term which we gave to a lot of historical ideas. We kind of merged them together. In a way, the concept of a vampire puts everything around it, everything that built up to it, and even other folk monsters, oftentimes not even European ones, into its shadow. The image that we produced, the image of vampires, werewolves, zombies, basically any monster, kind of fits as a cultural stand-in for this seemingly universal idea that dead things wanting to stay alive unnaturally is bad, and one which seems really rooted to the culture in which it's produced. I don't know that we've ever really tried to separate vampires from the sexual and economic ideas that they put forward. Modern vampire stories often are really good, really deep little metaphors. There's a reason that Mr. Burns plays a vampire on The Simpsons. Even modern vampires that are wildly different, like Twilight, are still deeply connected with a sexual iconography. Also, we were too hard on Twilight. Let girls have a thing that they like. When have men ever taken a spooky monster and made it sexy in a piece of media? Never before. The vampire may be a reflection of something eternal, but it's also this hodgepodge of ideas that we've stuck together. And it's a set of ideas that has been a creative playground for people ever since. When Dracula kind of sets the mold, a lot of other things and a lot of new media take vampires in new and interesting places. The modern vampire story is a reflection of modernity. It's a reflection of the fears and anxieties of the Industrial Revolution, and the reason that we've stuck with the idea since is that we're still living in the shadow of the Industrial Revolution. The vampire is a mirror of what modern storytelling is, and it's also our longest-lasting and most resilient villain. Next time we talk about vampires, I'm going to tell you about how that image changes when it jumps to an entirely new form of media, once we get to the silver screen. Baby. I want to tell you some recommendations. Recommendations! 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 Yeah. My fiancé slash producer and I just watched Last Night in Soho. I'm going to talk about it on the next episode, but I really liked it. When a performance reminds you of people you know, God, it's electrifying. Like, everything else about the movie, if there are plot holes or if there is some problem with the editing, none of that I noticed at all, because that performance really, really swept me away. Additionally, you should go check out Chucky. I've only seen what's out so far, but it's really good. It talks about some heavy themes relating to LGBTQ issues that I really can't tell you if it's good or not, so be aware of that. But the show itself seemed well-written, snappy, funny, deeply likable. The teenagers are played by teenagers. It's Chucky in a school, bonding with a guy and then killing all the rich jerks that are mean to him. There is a love interest, and the love interest is the cutest boy, and they're so cute together. I ship them, the main romantic relationship of a show, I still ship them. Please take a second to like and share and comment. I missed a ton of stuff because I could do a million episodes about vampires. If you got any cool stories or cool ideas, please share them down below. Check out our beautiful podcast. And otherwise, duck in tight. We'll see you in a couple weeks. Peace.